Audible.com is the leading provider in spoken word entertainment, including books, magazines, newspapers, and podcasts. They have over 35,000 books to choose from, including a large selection of conservative titles. Log on to audible.com/townhall to get a free audiobook download when you sign up today. Again, that's audible.com/townhall for your free audiobook.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Dennis Prager Show. One of the great myths of American history is that our general inclination was to leave the world alone, live in our large, wonderful, secluded place in the U.S. of A., and not meddle around the world, not have terrible interests. Americans tend to be somewhat narrowly focused on the United States. It's a grand myth. I don't know how it developed. But whereas it may be true in some ways about the popular culture, it has not been true about American foreign policy. And there is a book just published where I'm a little annoyed with the author, and I want to explain why. Folks, the last thing I needed was another book I had to read. The pile is pretty high. I narrow that pile. I reduce it as much as I can, but this is on top right now. In fact, I even took it on the listener cruise to Australia, which put me overweight. In fact, I weighed the luggage. The book is Power, Faith, and Fantasy. A terrific title. It's exactly, I guess, summarize it. I have only begun it, really. America in the Middle East, 1776 to the present. And the author, Michael Oren, has been on this program a number of times. He wrote the standard work on the Six-Day War. First of all, I'm sorry, Michael Oren. Welcome to the Dennis Prager Show. I have to begin that way.
Dennis, it's really good to be back with you. Thanks.
That's very kind. I have to just ask you, how do you write such important works of history? These are not novels. And I'm not putting down novels, but the novel just comes from one brain, one often, unless it's a historical novel, doesn't have to do all that much research. How do you write this quickly?
Well, I have a good institute behind me, the Shalem Center in Israel. I was teaching in the United States last year at Harvard and Yale. I got some of these kids to do my proofreading for me. They were great. But, you know, we live during historical times, Dennis, and historical times don't give you a lot of time to sit around and think. You have to act. And I thought it was very crucial that Americans who are being asked to make very faithful decisions about their future in the Middle East, and those decisions are going to impact not just America's security, but the security of the world. I felt it was very important that they had a book which provided them with a historic context of America in the Middle East, and there was no such book, believe it or not.
That's right. That's why you make that point in the beginning. There is no such book. Well, there is now. It's Power, Faith, and Fantasy. So let us begin at the beginning. What engendered America's first involvement in the Middle East?
A war. America's first foreign war was in the Middle East. America's longest foreign engagement was in the Middle East, the Barbary Wars, which began literally on the day that America achieved its independence, 1776, when American commerce was no longer protected by the British Navy, and American commerce to the Middle East, which was vital for America's economy, about 20% of America's exports went to the Middle East, was being attacked by the so-called Barbary pirates, pirates that were basically state-sponsored by the Barbary states of what is today Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya. And America had no means of fighting back against these pirates. The 13 states were loosely confederated. There was no central government, no constitution, no means of creating a navy, and America didn't have a navy. So the first question the United States had to ask, or these 13 states, the United States back then was a plural noun, they had to ask themselves whether they were going to unite and to fight back against this Middle Eastern threat, or whether they're going to honor the follow the age-old European practice of paying off the pirates.
That's the best.
You like that?
Nothing has changed.
How about the fact that Thomas Jefferson went to the Europeans and asked them to form a coalition against the Middle East, and the Europeans turned them down, especially the French?
Tout ça change, tout ça la même chose. That's a riot. The more things change, the more they stay the same. A famous French phrase. That is priceless. The Europeans paid off the pirates, and we fought them.
and they turned us down in a coalition. Continental Congress sent Jefferson over to meet with the emissary of what is today Libya, a guy named Abdul Rahman, in March of 1785. And Jefferson said to Abdul Rahman, the American people don't want war in the Middle East, we just want peace with you. And Abdul Rahman turned to Jefferson and said, no, we want war with you. We have a holy book, it's called the Quran, and it tells us that we have to wage holy war against all infidel states. The United States is an infidel state. We're going to enslave you. And the Holy Book also says that if we die in the course of conducting this war, that our soldiers will go to heaven. Now, quote, unquote, Jefferson quotes this verbatim in his report to Congress. Now, if that's not familiar, I don't know what is.
This is eye-opening for just about everybody listening. That's one of the reasons this is such an important book, and it's been highly well-received. The Washington Post gave it a terrific review. Talking about Thomas Jefferson, are you familiar with the what's called Jefferson's Quran?
Very familiar. It's actually in the book, and I was shocked to see that the America's first Muslim congressman, Ellison, swore in over it, because that book found is a Quran found in Thomas Jefferson's library, was the translation made by an English lawyer named George Sales in 1734. And I'm sure nobody opened up this Quran before this gentleman swore on it, because the introduction states, George Sales says that I am translating the Quran so that good Christians will know their Muslim enemies and can better defeat them.
You don't know how many emails I got saying, you see, if the Quran was good for Jefferson, then by golly, it's good for Ellison and America.
I suggest they open it up and look at the introduction of the book.
And that's in your book?
It's in the book, yeah.
So that's written even before this happened. It wasn't even a response to that.
Mm-hmm.
What were these Barbary? By the way, for those who don't know, Barbary is the adjective from the word Berber, which is the Berber Mountains, which is North Africa's mountains. What were these Barbary pirates doing?
Well, they were going out and attacking our boats. Again, about 20% of America's commerce is going through the Middle East, so it's actually vital for America's survival. We had a very fragile economy back then. And they were taking the cargoes, and they were enslaving the crews. At the time of the Continental Congress in May of 1787, there were 127 American sailors who had been enslaved by these Barbary states. America was facing its first hostage crisis in 1787 in the Middle East. And we had no means of redeeming them.
What would they do to these people?
Well,
what does it mean?
They sent them to work in the mines. They sent them to work as galley slaves.
And how many were taken?
All together, several hundred. In 1801, when America lost a battleship in Tripoli Harbor, the USS Philadelphia, over 300 American sailors were kept hostage.
And did we redeem them?
Eventually, we had to pay a lot of money. During the John Adams administration in the 1790s, America was paying about one-fifth of its national budget to bribes and ransoms in the Middle East.
Well, then how did the war – did we win through war or through ransom?
We won through war, but it took a long time. There were many setbacks. And it wasn't until 1805, after Jefferson became president, that those nine Marines and 250 mercenaries marched 500 miles across the Libyan desert to attack Tripoli from behind. That's where the Shores of Tripoli line comes in the Marine anthem. And it wasn't until 1815, until Stephen Decatur, the Commodore for whom about 20 cities are named in this city, in this nation, sailed a fleet into the Barbary Coast ports and literally forced them at cannon point to sign a surrender.
All right, and then... Then do we take a respite from the Middle East because we're no longer attacked by these Islamic pirates, or what?
Oh, no, on the contrary. America became increasingly involved in the Middle East in different ways. There was what I call the agents of faith. Shortly after the Barbary Wars, America's first missionaries went to the Middle East. And these missionaries changed the whole face of the Middle East. I can't think of one group that had a more profound impact on the Middle East than these American missionaries. Because what they did was they built the school systems in the Middle East, the first modern elementary schools, secondary schools, the first modern universities, the American University of Beirut, the American University of Cairo. And through these institutions, they began to impart American ideas of patriotism, civic virtue, and democracy. And they promoted the existence of an entirely new movement in the Middle East, the secular Arab nationalist movement. And it's those Arab nationalists who later on threw off the yoke of Ottoman rule in the Middle East. Later still, they would gain independence from the Europeans. So these missionaries really changed everything. And then there were the travelers. Fantasy.
Keep the travelers on in abeyance for a moment. Okay. We'll talk about the missionaries. When we come back, was the missionaries' view in the Middle East primarily to convert? That's what we think of when the popular term of missionary. Or was it just do good works? Or was it in fact both? Michael Oren and the book. As I told you, I believe necessary reading, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America in the Middle East, 1776 to the Present. His name is spelled O-R-E-N. The phone number here is 1-8-PRAGER-776, and this is The Dennis Prager Show. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. It doesn't get more riveting than this. America's involvement in the Middle East and since we became a nation in 1776. The book is Power, Faith, and Fantasy, Michael Oren, O-R-E-N. And he's in Israel, but he's just been teaching at Harvard and Yale, apparently, as he just described the interns there. And we had him on for his terrific book on the Six-Day War, and now this. And we began very early, to summarize, and that is fighting pirates there. Let's take a quick call here from Scottsdale, Arizona. And Steve, hello, Steve. Dennis Prager and Michael Oren.
Yes, Professor Oren, I have your book. It's excellent. As Dennis said, it's long overdue. There's nothing like this. But Dennis, at the beginning of this segment, you talked about how we shouldn't perpetuate myths. One of the myths that's perpetuated is that these were Barbary pirates. Pirates are international outlaws who owe allegiance to no nation. These were jihadist warriors at sea, attacking under the banner of their local city-state, Algiers, Tunis, Tripoli, et al., at the direction of their government. Thus, the conflict that Jefferson and later presidents had to deal with was not fighting pirates, but rather fighting an enemy state. And I'd like a comment on that.
Yeah, Michael Oren.
No question about it, Stephen. Thanks for the kind words about the book. No question about it. These were state-sponsored pirates. It was an institution that had died out in the West around the era of Sir Francis Drake. He was a state-sponsored pirate as well. But no question. And these were jihadists. That's why I included that document that Jefferson sends to Congress in March of 1785. I don't think I even had to spell that out for my contemporary American readers who recognize a jihadist when they read one.
Yeah, that was extraordinary. All right, now we continue that America changes the Middle East with its missionaries. Two questions. One was, what was the purpose of a missionary in the Middle East? And two, did it really change anything in light of what we're dealing with now? Maybe there was an American University of Beirut, but so what? In the sum total of things, I don't know if there was really any impact.
Well, let me first start off with how I define faith in this book, which is the central component here, and frankly was the component that loomed particularly large, and I was surprised by how large it was, the faith-based content of America's involvement in the Middle East over the past two centuries. Faith I define not only as the impact of Christian faith, primarily Protestant faith, but also the no less irrepressible missionary urge to spread American ideas abroad. Particularly patriotism, civic virtues, and democracy. And you'll see from the missionaries in the Middle East just how closely linked the two were. The first American missionaries who traveled to the Middle East, their names were Pliny Fisk and Levi Parsons. And they left Boston in 1818. They gave a parting sermon at Old South Church, in which they declared their purpose in the Middle East was to help ingather the Jews into Palestine and to recreate the Jewish state. Failing that, they hoped to convert the Arab Muslims to Christianity. Now, they got to the Middle East, Fisk and Parsons, and found that the Jews did not want to ingather under their auspices. They found that if they tried to convert the Muslim Arabs, they'd lose their heads, because proselytizing is a capital offense under Islam. And so they turned to building these schools. And in these schools, they not only taught modern subjects by, astronomy and algebra, but they also taught American ideas, and they went from one part of one sort of faith to another sphere of faith very, very quickly. And through the universities, they helped create this Arab nationalist movement, which became just monumentally important for the future political development of the Middle East. There's a direct line between, for example, the emergence of a Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt in the 1950s and the graduates of the first class of the American University of Beirut in the 1770s, who went to Egypt and founded the first Arab nationalist newspapers that introduced these ideas to Egypt.
Well, in light of this, it's not as if Arab nationalism had any democratic component to it. Again, my question to you is, since they couldn't missionize on behalf of Christianity, they would be killed, and since they obviously did not inculcate American civic values, all they succeeded in doing is making an Arab nationalism which produced a virulently anti-Western, anti-democratic man like Gamal Abdel Nasser. So with all the wonderful, and these were wonderful human beings, what did they do any good in the sum total of things?
Well, besides that, they introduced Western education to this world.
Yeah, I know, but
has a hope of succeeding in the 21st century. It's largely because of these institutions, because believe me, they're not learning it from, you know, some of these homegrown Middle Eastern institutions. They're not learning it at the University of Riyadh. They're learning it at American institutions. And Nasser, yeah, he was no Democrat. The Arabs took from the missionaries' teaching what they wanted. They wanted the nationalism. They didn't want the democracy. But nationalism, but you look at Nasser from, say, Arab eyes, he was a great hero. He secured Egypt's freedom from Great Britain, which was an immense achievement for them.
Right. My question is, though, what good did it do the world, not what good did it do those who loved Nasser?
Well, put it this way. Today we sort of look back at figures like Nasser. Even in Egypt we look back at him and say, boy, there was a powerful man who could have made peace. Now we have to deal with the Islamic extremists, with whom there's no possibility of compromise.
In other words, it was a better movement because it was a secular nationalism.
Precisely. Precisely. We look back with longing to these people today.
Well, that's quite, I don't lose sleep over. Yeah, all right. Let's go to Mark in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Mark. Dennis Prager and Michael Oren.
Hi, Dennis and Mr. Oren. You mentioned that the war between the Barbary Coast lasted up to the 1800s, but you failed to mention that America had a treaty with Morocco from the 1780s, a 50-year treaty for peace and friendship. And in the book The Crescent Obscured, they document they captured the ships, the American ships, and they held the American prisoners. And it's a beautiful play called The Patriot of 76, where they had the American captive in Algiers and an American black who fought in the Revolutionary War. Both of them were in prison, but one was in the jails in America and the other was in the jails of Algeria. And they wrote beautifully about how they were treated better as slaves in Algeria than the slaves in America.
That's a great question. Can I answer, Dennis?
Yeah, please,
Mark,
yes.
Thank you for all that. The relationship with America had treaty with all the Barbary states at one time or another. Morocco was actually claimed to be the first foreign country to recognize America's independence in 1777. And America signed its first ever treaty with Morocco. The first treaty was with France. And the treaty is reproduced in the book. It's beautiful. You see the signature of Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and then a signature in Arabic, which is the signature of the emperor with a Ramadan date beneath it. America's first, second treaty had an Islamic.
Was that, was it in that that there was the claim that America was not a Christian nation?
Well, now that comes later, but very important to say that the Barbary pirates then turned around and broke all these treaties.
Oh.
And Jefferson said, you know, you sign these treaties, they're only good as the lives of their rulers, and then they break them.
All right, we'll continue too. The book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, Michael Oren. I'm Dennis Prager. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. I'm speaking to Michael Oren, O-R-E-N, the prominent historian, and his latest book is about the U.S. and the Middle East since 1776. It's titled Power, Faith, and Fantasy, and how we have always been involved. In fact, our first war was there, the Navy. Was it the Navy that was developed as a result of that?
The Navy was created specifically to fight in the Middle East, according to an act of Congress from 1794.
To fight those Barbary pirates, the Islamic pirates who were taking on behalf of their states, as you and a caller pointed out, to take slaves. Is there, when we say slavery, is there any correlation between the transatlantic slave trade of black Africans and this type of slavery?
Well, it wasn't so much a commercial connection as there was an intellectual and literary connection. Many of the American white people who escaped from slavery in North Africa came home and wrote their memoirs. And they became strong abolitionists because these were the first white Americans who knew what it was like to be slaved and enslaved by Africans. And the situation, of course, was reversed in the United States. The last essay written by Benjamin Franklin before he died in 1790, Benjamin Franklin posed as a Middle Eastern prince named Muhammad Ali, who was justifying retaining his white American slaves using the arguments that white American slave owners used to enslave their blacks here. He was using parody. But that became a whole genre in American abolitionist writing. And one of the people who escaped from slavery was a gentleman named James Riley, who came back to America in 1812 and wrote his memoirs. And they became a bestseller. They sold out 1 million copies. And among the reading in this book, he rails against the institution of slavery in the United States. He says, "Now I know what it feels like to be a slave, and we're hypocrites." And among the many readers of this book was a young Indiana farm boy named Abraham Lincoln, who later listed James Riley's books as one of the three books that most influenced his political thinking.
How interesting and ironic. All right, as time is moving on, I want to move on chronologically. So after the Barbary Pirates, we send missionaries. The missionaries have two functions I'm reviewing here. Three, but one they gave up on immediately because they would have been killed, was to spread Christianity. The other was to spread American values of democracy and civic virtues. And the other one was to help bring the Jews back to the Promised Land.
Yeah, they were what we'd call Zionists today.
Right, Christian Zionists.
Yes.
So this notion that people have that this is a very new phenomenon of Christians supporting the Jews is just wrong.
No, it goes back to Puritan times. The Puritans saw themselves as the new Jews, settling a new promised land, and they felt very close to the old Jews and the old promised land, and they concluded that to be good Christians and good Americans, that they had to help God fulfill his promises to the Jews in the Old Testament, which was to restore them to their ancient homeland. That's the notion of restorationism. And it wasn't an evangelical notion, Dennis. You had John Adams, the second president of the United States, saying that his fondest wish that 100,000 Jewish soldiers would march back into Palestine and reclaim it as a Judean kingdom. Abraham Lincoln in 1863 said restoring the Jews to their holy land was a dream that was dear to a great many Americans, and Lincoln hoped that he could help fulfill that dream once he had restored the American Union after the Civil War.
And how would America facilitate that?
Well, people had different ideas. A book appeared in 1844 called Valley of the Visions, which again became a best-selling book. It called on the United States government to spearhead an international effort to detach Palestine from the Ottoman Empire and to give it back to the Jews. It even called on the U.S. Navy to help provision the Jewish state until it could stand on its own economic legs. That book, Valley of the Visions, was written by the head of the Hebrew Language Department of New York University, a professor named George Bush. And 2 days in the genealogy room of the Library of Congress, Dennis, enabled me to prove that Professor George Bush from 1844 was a direct forebear of two American presidents by the same name.
Wow. Must have given you the chills.
Very much.
All right. So at this time, Palestine, which is a geographic rather than a political entity, is that correct?
More like Appalachia, yes. It's
yes.
An area.
Is part of the Ottoman Empire, which is modern Turkey. Mm-hmm. And who is living there?
Well, all different types of Bedouin tribesmen. They didn't call themselves the Palestinians, certainly. And there were a great number of Jews. But when these two American missionaries first came to Palestine in 1819, Fisk and Parsons, they were surprised to find that there were 10,000 Jews living in the city of Jerusalem. And the Jews eventually, over the course of the 19th century, became the largest single group in Jerusalem.
Did they have any interaction?
Not much, but a later American missionary to Palestine, a gentleman by the name of Warder Crescent, who also served as America's first consul general in Jerusalem, was so impressed with the ability...
All right, hold on. You'll tell us that in a moment. We'll continue with Michael Oren and Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager here with historian Michael Oren, O-R-E-N. I'm riveted by this history and by his book. Power, Faith, and Fantasy, and it's linked to PragerRadio.com. Michael Oren's book, America in the Middle East, 1776 to the Present. And it doesn't seem like much has changed. It is so remarkable. We're talking about the involvement in the 19th century of many American missionaries in the Middle East, but the missionaries could not spread Christianity. That would be under pain of execution in the Muslim world. And so they built Americanized institutions of learning, spread secular Arab nationalist ideas, and worked strongly to bring Jews back into what became Israel, or what was Israel and then became it again, in the 19th century. Now, let's move on ahead here. That's the 19th century in a very small, obviously, a tiny nutshell. Is the next great event the discovery of oil?
No, the great next event is World War One. And we talk about the impact of the missionaries, Dennis. Remember, America goes to war in 1917. And it goes to the war against the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary. And the third Central Power was the Ottoman Empire. And the United States had to decide to go to war, whether or not to go to war in the Middle East. Both houses of Congress were very supportive of going to war in the Middle East. But the president was Woodrow Wilson, who was descended from missionaries and very close to them. And the missionaries came to Wilson and said, Mr. President, you go to war in the Middle East, the Turks will do to us, to the missionaries, what they're doing to the Armenians. And they have been massacring the Armenians. And so Wilson
decided, they actually mentioned the Armenians by name?
Yes.
Fascinating.
Sir. And Wilson decided not to go to war in the Middle East. And the result was, at the end of the war, the British had about 1 million soldiers in the Middle East. The French had a couple hundred thousand. And guess who got to draw the post-World War I map of the Middle East? Not the United States. And so the missionaries had that influence, too, of keeping America out of diplomacy after World War One, and that really drew the map of the modern Middle East.
Why? Had America been involved, we'd have had a different map?
Well, we might not have had a Lebanon, might not have had a Jordan. Pretty certain we'd have a Palestine as a Jewish state, because the Woodrow Wilson was personally supportive of that, He personally supported the Balfour Declaration, but they didn't want this. They didn't want the French in Syria. And they didn't necessarily want the British in Palestine either.
Mm-hmm. The United States, all right, that's the next great event, and that draws the map of the Middle East, and we're suffering from that to this day.
Right.
Since Iraq was manufactured at that time as well.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And the missionaries actually had a deep connection with oil, believe it or not.
And that was?
Well, first of all, between 1880 and 1914, America was the principal exporter of oil to the Middle East. But starting in the 1890s, American missionaries from Wisconsin went to the Arabian Peninsula. And, of course, they couldn't proselytize either, so they built hospitals. These hospitals began to keep tribesmen belonging to the Saud tribe, including the head of the tribe, Ibn Saud, who loved these American doctors. And when he created his Saudi kingdom in 1928, and the British and the French came to him and said, let us prospect for oil under your sand, he says, no, I don't trust you. I trust these American doctors. And he gave the contracts to American oil companies.
That is the next big event.
That is definitely a big event. But the oil in commercial quantities wasn't discovered till 1938, and it wasn't until the end of World War II when America began to think, hey, we're sort of dependent on this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And the of course, Israel is founded in 1948. Speak to the issue of the depth of commitment to a Jewish state in that area from 1776.
Well, we started earlier talking about the Puritans, how they felt it was their duty as good Christians and good Americans to help God fulfill his promises to restore the Jews. And we talked about John Adams and Abraham Lincoln. Starting in the 1830s, groups of Americans started to go to Palestine to create colonies there. You probably know the American Colony Hotel.
Sure.
In Jerusalem. That was the last of these colonies. That was from the 1880s. All of these colonies were designed to teach the Jews how to farm, because they had forgotten how to farm during their years of exile. And these good Jeffersonian Americans wanted these Jews to have an agrarian basis for their modern state.
By the way, the depth of America's support for the Jews in the Middle East is belies this notion that evangelical Christians and others who support Israel today do so because of some doomsday eschatological theology that Jesus will return as a result, and then Israel and the Jews will be destroyed, and this is what is animating support for Israel. But when you describe how long this is gone on, it is hardly a function of that.
You know, I just small example, 1891, a gentleman named William Blackstone petitions the Harrison White House to call an international conference together with Queen Victoria of England and the Tsar of Russia to force the Ottomans to give Palestine to the Jews. And this petition is signed by 400 leading Americans, including John D. Rockefeller, J. Pierpont Morgan, and William McKinley. So this was not a peripheral notion, Dennis. This was America's elite supporting the recreation of a Jewish state.
And is that what animates Harry Truman?
Harry Truman has read his Bible. He knew his Bible almost by heart by age 14. And he was a member of a restorationist group, the American Christian Palestine Committee. And in May of 1948, in an incident which is completely unique in the history of American foreign policy, the entire American foreign policy establishment, the State Department, the Defense Department, Secretary of State George Marshall, say to Truman, if you recognize this Jewish state, it's going to cause a global catastrophe. The Arabs are going to cut off oil to the West. Europe will fall to the communists. And Truman listens to this almost alone. He goes into the White House for 24 hours, and at 6:11 p.m. on May 14th, 11 minutes after Israel declared its independence, Harry Truman makes the United States the first nation on earth to recognize the newly created Jewish state. I believe he did this out of faith.
Yep, and it's faith and idealism, as Robert Kagan points out in his review of your book, and I've had him on as well, his review in the Washington Post. It's faith and idealism that has been the primary shapers of American foreign policy in the Middle East and elsewhere. Michael Oren, what's your next book?
My next book will probably be on the 1948 Israel War of Independence, which, again, there's no comprehensive book, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And people don't understand how.
Well, you'll certainly be on this show. Good luck to you. Good luck.
Thank you, Dennis. Be well.
Thank you very much. Some comments from me, the book Power, Faith, and Fantasy, and calls from you when we come back. I suspect you were as riveted as I was by Michael Oren, O-R-E-N, who has written this book about America's involvement in the Middle East since our inception. Listening, I have to tell you, listening to the beginnings with our fight against Barbary pirates, these were the Islamic-sponsored states, state-sponsored, really terrorists of that time. They would terrorize ships, and they would take Americans and others as prisoners. And then the way he described the way in which Europe dealt with them was to pay them off, and we decided to fight them. There really is a difference between the United States and Europe. There has always been a difference, and this, I cannot think of a better example because it's so old, and it goes back to the origins of our country. And then the point made here, people pointed out that when the congressman, the first Muslim congressman, used the quote-unquote Jefferson Quran, and it was such a brilliant stroke, all the newspapers wrote what a brilliant stroke that was. But in this book, written before this ever happened, and page 42 of the book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, I read to you, the 1734 version, that is, of an English language Quran, by the lawyer George Sales, aimed at enabling Protestants, quote, to attack the Quran with success, and for them, quote, Providence has reserved the glory of its overthrow. That is, of Islam's overthrow. That was the reason. That is what was written in the introduction to it, and that is used as an example of look at how worldly and tolerant and multiculturalist Thomas Jefferson was. I mean, he was worldly, but he wasn't multiculturalist. He wanted the seal of the United States to depict the Jews leaving Egypt. This continues to be the battle in our day of what is the nature of the United States of America, but this book certainly can give you an idea of what animated American foreign policy in the Middle East, and as it has animated it elsewhere, a belief that we have religious moral values and they're not easily separated. The religious, the Judeo-Christian and moral values that have animated this country in making its policy abroad and making its domestic policies. That is the battle over the United States at the present time. But whether you're interested in that battle or not, I can't think of anything comparable to this book to give you an overview of America in the Middle East. This is Dennis Prager. Don't go away.